Let me quickly and more formally introduce the today's speakers, and then I ask them, I invite them to also introduce themselves a little bit more with their own perspective on their biography from somewhere to the learning sciences. Let me start with Marsha Lin, who is now a professor of development and cognition at the Graduate School of Education at the University of California at Berkeley. She holds a bachelor's degree in psychology and statistics and also a master's degree in educational psychology and a PhD also in educational psychology from Stanford University. She received a number of awards, and we more or less stop doing that at some point, mention all the awards. You can also look her Wikipedia page up or the Wikipedia page about her. Let me mention one very specific thing that was already mentioned by Annelies. So I think there are several groups in the world that really benefited from the technology development under an educational and pedagogical perspective that has taken place over the last two decades, and even longer if you look into the Vita in Berkeley. And also our group has very much benefited from the WISE environment. We had two PhDs or even three PhDs building their work on this. Let me mention one more thing that I find especially also interesting, and then we let also Marsha, of course, talk about her perspective. Marsha, in the earlier phase of her career, worked for some time in Geneva together with Jean Piaget, and she also worked later on with a couple of other very important, eminent psychologists, and maybe Marsha will also tell us about this. Let me also quickly introduce Astrid Wichmann, who started doing that herself, actually, but this is not a problem for me to, because what she didn't mention is that she started her academic education in information science at Saarland University, but then went to the US at the University of Missouri, where she received her master's degree of education in educational technology from the College of Education. Then went back to Germany, did her PhD in the Department of Instructional Psychology at the University of Duisburg-Essen on multi-level support with respect to inquiry, explanations, and regulation during an inquiry cycle. And she's currently a research assistant, a postdoc research assistant, and this is what she already mentioned, with Nicole Rummel at the Ruhr University of Bochum. So, welcome to both of you and to all others as well, of course, and we are looking forward to your quick no matter how long it will take to give us your own perspective on your trajectory through the different sciences, and then of course we look forward to your talk about inquiry.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you so much, Frank, for setting this up and for organizing the Naples Symposium series. I think this is making a very big difference in the learning sciences, and that we can really be excited that this ability to bring together people from around the world is really helping to expand our community and also to extend our understanding to include a much wider range of individuals who are all concerned about the same important topics, such as inquiry learning. I'm especially excited to have Annelies and Ingeborg and other people who have worked with us in the past participate, and I know that you'll learn as much from them as you'll learn from those of us here at Berkeley. I want to also really thank Astrid Wichmann, who really helped shape this whole presentation and will remind me when we need to be following the right sequence and schedule here. Thank you so much, Astrid, for all of your help and encouragement. I'm supposed to give a brief summary of my background. Frank did a very good job. I did, if you go to slide two, and hopefully I put numbers on them, but they're kind of small. But On slide two, I put out a few funny things that might be of interest to you to give you a sense of how I got involved in technology and education. Actually, before that, when I was at Stanford, I worked with Lee Kronbach, but also with Pat Soupy's and Dick Atkinson on their very first uses of mainframe computers to tutor children. So I have a long history with technology and education. However, in 85, finally, there were personal computers that could be used, and I was very lucky to receive this Apple Wheels for the Mind grant for the Computers Lab partner. And we actually deployed those in schools. We're still working in some of the same schools, and that's when we met Mr. K, our beloved teacher, who really helped us understand how students learn and how technology can be used well in the classroom. But I thought it would be interesting to show you the Apple IIgs because when that came out, which was about in 86, we actually made a film that I still have showing me and Bob Tinker and Mr. K all walking around the classroom dressed in peculiar clothes of the era and talking about how exciting it is to use technology in education. And I think we would still be just as excited to talk about what we're doing today if we were to make the next version of that film. We also, I also had the opportunity shortly after that to direct our instructional technology program at Berkeley and work with all the faculty to find ways to make technology a good thing for the campus. And that was really interesting because it turned out among the 2,000 faculty on campus, many people were doing really exciting things. And so part of my job was to find miracles and display those for the rest of the faculty. And it was very exciting. We also invited leaders from all the major technology companies to come to campus. And that was a very good opportunity for our campus to extend use of technology. We're going to talk primarily today about pre-college, but many of the principles that we developed apply equally well to college. In 2006, with Bob Tinker, Jim Slotta, and many other leaders in this field, we were lucky to receive the TELS grant, the Technology Enhanced Learning and Science grant, which was really intended to build a platform that could be used universally. And that's the WISE platform. You heard already that Annalise is using that platform, and Ingeborg and her colleagues in Norway have also used WISE, as well as people around the world. And I have, at the end of this slideshow, there's a bunch of kind of four-year information slides, and one lists some of the collaborators around the world that you might be interested in knowing about. But that's my introduction. I think we should let Astrid introduce herself because she's really part of this undertaking, and then we'll proceed with the first inquiry activity.
Thanks, that I can say a few words. Just want to say my experience doesn't go that far away, but at least I started having a computer in 1994. That's already very early, but not 1985. It's really amazing that you guys started to work with technology so early. I was happy to have inquiry experiences inside and outside of the classroom. I was working in Sweden, for instance, in a museum to work with students on enriching inquiry experiences in informal settings. So I think this combination of using inquiry learning inside and outside of schools is very exciting, and I'm looking forward to Marcia's talk now.
Okay, well, great. So if you look at slide three, that will really give another image of all the marvelous people that have contributed to this project. Camelia Matuk has just joined us. She's one of the designers that's worked with us as well. Libby's work and Camelia's work and really all the work of this group is represented in the examples that we'll talk about today. So let's go on to slide four. This shows some of the visualizations that we've used. I think our philosophy is really that we want to encourage inquiry and take advantage of technology. And the technologies that have been most exciting to take advantage of are definitely visualizations and virtual experiments and simulations, all the different things that are represented in this slide and many, many others around the world. And one of the things that we found as we started to do that is that these really don't stand on their own. In fact, they're kind of useless on their own. Teachers get tired of them. They really can't figure out why they're using them. And, you know, they abandon them for good reason, because visualizations need guidance and scaffolding in order to be successful. And that's where our knowledge integration framework developed. We've done a ton of research trying to figure out what make good scaffolds and guidance in order to promote inquiry. And I'm just going to talk about a few of those examples today, but kind of try to illustrate in this talk as well the process that we use. So one of the most important things about doing inquiry is illustrated on slide 5. Essentially figuring out what students know. I mean, if you don't know what the students know, then how are you going to build on their ideas? In addition, if you don't know what they know or don't think about what they know, then as I learned when I worked with Piaget, students might embrace the suggestions that you're giving them in the moment, but shortly thereafter, they will simply return to the ideas that they already had, and that's understandable. They've spent a lot more time exploring and learning those ideas than they have exploring and learning the ideas that you presented for a short period of time. So one of the most important things is to understand what students' ideas are, and I thought we'd start by really trying to think about global climate change and what do students that in your community or that you've worked with or people you've spoken to, what are some of their ideas about global climate change or global warming? You can talk among yourselves and raise your hand to tell us the ideas from your group. You can make your own predictions in the chat. If you want some ideas, you can look at the responses on slide 6. So any of those activities are good. I think adding ideas to chat is a really good thing to do. So if you can find the chat box, then feel free to put your ideas there, and also raise your hand if you have some ideas from your group that you'd like to contribute to our overall discussion. Does someone here want to volunteer? Okay. Okay, people are suggesting ice cap or melt getting warmer, cold weather, global warming is not happening, it's changing. Mm-hmm. Can you figure out how to get it on to get cold weather? Can you talk? Is your mic on?
No, not because it'll interrupt the choice.
Okay, I turn mine on, so it's off so you can talk. The ozone layer is really thin.
Sorry to interrupt, Berkeley, we can actually not clearly hear you. Maybe you use Marsha's account better, or there's still, or go closer to the microphone then.
Hi. So we tried to figure it out here, but we're getting confused. So lots of great ideas are being contributed, calls by people who use oil, cars and factories, car pollution. Middle school students say it's caused by bovine methane emissions. Yes, so this is one of the students that students in California aren't really familiar with what it means, but they love it. They think that anything that's gross is really makes science so much better. And people are mentioning the ozone layer, which is a really interesting idea. And John Vitale, who's out in schools today working with kids learning about global climate change, has been really trying to think about how to deal with this common view that students have about ozone being a major issue and not really being able to differentiate that from greenhouse gas accumulation. So those are important issues to consider. These are really, really great ideas. Does any group want to contribute their ideas, or have we got them pretty much in chat here? The chat has some really excellent excellent suggestions. Let's go on and look at slide 6. And you can see some of the ideas that Tammy Vizentainer elicited when she interviewed students in a local middle school. one of the things that I really thought was interesting, and it's also represented in the chat, is that students think that just the fact that heat is emitted by cars is a sufficient thing, so that it's actually the heat itself. There's no process or chemical relationship or global or greenhouse gas accumulation issue. It's really just heat heats up the environment. So those are all ideas that students frequently come up with. And if you go on to slide 7, I think that's right, yes. Seven. A really interesting question is, how do we build on these ideas? So certainly the main idea that a lot of people came up with had to do with the fact that there's more heat. But there also is the concern that several people mentioned in the chat, that students say it's really, you know, it's colder. So really that's not it. And I think that both of those views reflect this general feeling that, you know, it's the heat you put in directly or the heat you take out directly, rather than a more complicated process that has to do with climate change. And so our goal in trying to deal with this is to think about how can we add new ideas that we can help students use to sort out the ideas they have with the more normative ideas that have been developing in research in the field. So if you look at the next slide titled Why Elicit Ideas or Why Ask for Predictions, it summarizes what I've just said, that we need to understand the ideas that cause confusion, and it also suggests that we need to identify ideas that could build on the ideas that students have and help them understand why those ideas are helpful but not complete. And as I mentioned at the beginning, our goal has been to think about how to use visualizations to improve the students' understanding, and so we're going to look now at a visualization about global climate change. And the next slide, which is slide 9, shows you an artist's conception of our visualization. And you should be able to see on slide 10 a URL that will take you directly to this visualization displayed in HTML. And I hope that you're very excited that it is in HTML, because this has been a really big challenge for us. We had some great visualizations in Java, and they did not succeed in working in the current browser life. Let's see. I pasted the URL for the model into the chat as well. So please see if you can make this work. And I'd like each group to discuss at their location this visualization, run it, play with it. The slides, the first thing you're going to need to do once you run it is hit setup. It's going to just be black, which we're fixing that. With this is hot off the press. We are running this in schools this week, and it didn't run last week. So it's very new. You're getting the latest thing from California here, although it may remind you of the models that we had before. The original model was built by Bob Tinker, and been translated from NetLogo using a program developed at Northwestern to take their NetLogo models and make them into HTML5 models. And we have people here in the room, John Breitbart among them, who have been helping to make sure that they work in our units. You can look at our current we'll paste in the URL for the current a unit that has these models in it. So can somebody do that? So you can see them in the unit as well. But I think the best thing is to run this one as a standalone. If you're able to run it, would you please either raise your hand or vote? No, raise your hand. If you're able to run the visualization using the URL that's in the chat. Oh, somebody's put up a smiley face. That's perfect. Oh, great. Oh, several. Good. Okay. Everybody's getting it. So look at it. Play with it. Hit, once you get it going, first hit go, and then hit stop. And when you hit stop, you'll see the labels of on the things that you're seeing there I'm sorry, the legend isn't perfect. In the unit, there's a better legend. And if you look at the next slide, you'll see an example of the of it with a little better legend that tells you what is solar radiation, heat, infrared radiation, and greenhouse gases. So what I'd like you to do at your local locations is to discuss what you think students could learn from this, how we might be building on that idea of heat that we saw students had, and helping them understand that it's not the heat itself, but it's really a transformation and more complicated process. Once you've run it, you can also increase, you can run the factory, and the factory will add greenhouse gases, and you can also decrease greenhouse gases, which we wish that we could do this in real life and see the impact of that decrease on the global temperature, which is shown on the graph. If you're having any trouble, please enter your comments in the chat. And otherwise, I hope that you'll please have a discussion locally and raise your hand and tell me some of the ideas that you have about how this kind of visualization would help in an inquiry classroom for students to understand the process of global climate change and specifically deal with this view that they have that it's the heat in the, for example, the heat of exhaust that is a main factor in climate change.
So Marsha, should we give like 7 minutes so that also the local groups can discuss? And could you maybe also type in a short version of the task for the groups and the individuals?
Sure, yeah, it's shown basically you just have to launch the page, hit setup, hit stop, hit go and hit stop, but I'll put that in and it's also on the slides. And then on slide 10, it tells you some of the, no, on slide 12, it tells you some of the questions that you might consider discussing. And let's take 7 minutes to discuss them. That sounds great. If you want, though, to put comments in the chat, you can do that anytime.
So Marsha just gave a 1 minute warning. Ibrahim, you, I hope you can hear us. We can see you now. So we have one more minute for local discussions and so on, and then we go on. Okay, Ibrahim, I just interrupted you, so you don't have to press start broadcasting or join the queue. We can just see you in the thumbnail on the right-hand side, and only if you want to speak, please press join the queue or start broadcasting, and then press stop broadcasting once you're done. So Marsha is inviting comments now.
Yeah, so we were just discussing that with the new model, the graph that we're connecting is a smart grapher. And with it, since this is sort of just embedded agent and connected by JavaScript, we could do things like when a student changes up in the model, we could actually put a marker on a graph in the case that they change some parameter. So then we've had this where it's often difficult for students to connect changes in the with changes in the model. So if we had markers indicating what they changed on the graph, this might make that connection easier to test.
Annelies and me were just discussing about the different kinds of features that are within this visualization, and actually it's a visualization that is interactive. It, you cannot only see changes, so it's dynamic, it's also interactive because you can make manipulation, you can manipulate variables. And of course the question is how do the students actually benefit from that, or would they play the game, like, okay, how much can I push the button to get so many greenhouse gases that the whole area is black, and would they still make sense of it, or would they need to have some guidance to actually profit and benefit from these manipulation possibilities?
Hi there. So in response to the question that was posted in the chat about the scaffolding, we think that's a very interesting question, because like even here, for us, at least in this short amount of time, we needed some time to really understand the progress and to understand what's going on, what's happening, and to follow like the single rays to find out like what that they're actually bouncing off and all that stuff. So that would also be an interesting question also probably to Marsha, how much scaffolding or how much time maybe like if they have less scaffolding students need.
And actually what happened here is that someone saw, oh, the infrared radiation is not going all the way up, but it's bouncing off, and it was like giving a focus to some specific areas of the animation, which helped us to understand it.
Yeah.
Hi, definitely those are really good questions about how best to scaffold students' use of it. What we find is there's multiple models in the unit. If you go to the unit URL, you'll see that there's many activities. This is the most introductory one, but they also look at albedo, and actually there's an ozone model, which is very new, and if you do eventually get chance to look at that ozone model, we'd love your comments. This is really being trialed right now in the school for the very first time, and we're very interested in how students respond to it, and we'd be interested in your responses. I think that the good news is after they do a couple of these models, students are really going back to the early ones to look again at the ideas that they were exploring as they get a deeper understanding of how the models work. But other comments from other groups, please.
In the chat there is a comment by Liana from Oulu. Maybe we can also talk about that. Maybe Liana, you would also put that into the audio chat, video chat?
Yes. And just would like to say that I'm interested how such kind of tool can be applied to foster the process of inquiry. That is very interesting to see this very good example of that. And I can see what kind of opportunities can be benefited from this. That is also very interesting.
Okay, I'm going to let Ingeborg speak. She has some comments and she's here. Oh, go ahead. You could, Camelia? You guys want to talk over there? No? You're out.
I was just thinking, I was at the school this morning, and it was very interesting to see the students actually engage with this model. Just, I think, actually, just the fact that they can play around with it and actually get to slow it down and speed it up. Obviously, they'll play around a little bit at first, but they actually really start to get a sense of what's happening, especially connecting with the graph as well. It was very helpful for the students. But again, the teacher was saying maybe that it seems to be a case of maybe 4 or 6 students in the class seem to get it much faster than others. So, but she said, like, even that was brilliant. She was delighted.
Well, there we have firsthand experience from this morning. We try to always have up-to-the-minute information in our talks. Frank says, is scientific reasoning emerging, or does that have to be introduced explicitly? How do you scaffold this for teachers is another question. So for teachers, we have a teacher interface, and I didn't actually put that into the slides today, but we do have one that that helps the teachers know what the students are doing. The question about emerging scientific reasoning, maybe someone, does anyone want to comment on that here in the room? Do you want to comment, Libby, on how the students, this is Libby Girard.
Hi there, I do think that the teachers we've worked with that have used these models tend to develop strategies to help the students, help elicit that reason. And I'm not sure it emerges on its own. although this model is a lot smoother to allow for, and as John said, we can add in more scaffolds into the visualization itself, I think, to help students run experiments and constrain the kinds of choices that they can make. So for instance, did you already say this? That John was saying how you could mark, on the graph, right, when you change variables, for instance. And I do think the teachers have unique strategies, like stopping the whole class to show it up on the projector and elicit students' predictions, and then letting them explore on their own. I think, like Dermot said, there's probably 4 to 6 for that a reasoning will occur all on its own, but that the others probably need more scaffolding.
Great. So we have 2 scaffolding directions that I wanted to talk about today. And so if you go to the, there's a slide 25 shows you the interface for WISE. So you can see that we can give students a lot of guidance and ask them questions while they're interacting with WISE. If you're not familiar with WISE, I recommend that you go to the website and play with it, and you'll get a better sense of how it works. In slide 26, you'll see a summary of our knowledge integration framework. This slide was designed by Camelia Matouk, who you just saw sitting next to Libby, and gives you a sense of the process I talked about at the beginning, that students, we elicit all these ideas, but those often are good and bad. Then we add some ideas, and then we have students distinguish among them. And the issue is how to help people distinguish among ideas. And if you go on to slide 28, you'll see that one way that we help students distinguish ideas is to ask them to write explanations, which we then record, as you see, in that WISE interface. And we've been doing research very recently, just in the past year, on how to do automated guidance. And so I have one example in the slides where students are writing an answer to a question on burning coal. So can everybody find the question on slide 28? Just put a smiley face up if you've found it. I'm worried that it's not so easy to follow this. Yes, you found it, good, okay. So what you see there is that students on, you'll see their answer on slide 29. Burning coal would produce carbon dioxide, which becomes greenhouse gases, which would break parts of the ozone. Challenges. Here are students introducing the ozone layer, which isn't really relevant to the answer to this question, but in order to help them understand that, what we want to do is give them some guidance. So what you see in the next slide is the guidance that we actually are able to automatically, in the next slide that we make sure they really are confident about their answer. And then in the slide after that, you see the kind of guidance we can give you. Your answer needs more ideas. And it tells you to go back to step 4.3, which is the step we were just looking at. So they would go back to that model and explore it some more in order to give a more complete answer. And then you'll see that their answer is slightly, the next slide shows them revisiting that model. And then the slide after that, which is slide 33, shows you the kind of answer that they could get. So that's burning coal has increased the answer that they actually gave the response. Burning coal has increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide can increase the temperature of the climate. So it's not a perfect response, but they've gotten rid of the ozone idea, and they're focusing more on what the greenhouse gases might do, but they don't have a mechanism. There's a second example. We won't go through that because of time considerations, but the second example gives you a similar outcome for a group that has a slightly more sophisticated understanding of the greenhouse situation. And I think these two slides also show the kind of answers that students give. So as you can see, with the scaffolding that we provide in WISE, students are giving fairly complicated explanations for global climate. And then you'll see on the next slide that teachers and students give similar kinds of assessments of these items, so we're pretty accurate in our ability to represent the, to score these items. I think that in the interest of time, I just wanted to quickly show you one more example, and then I think we'll just wrap up. But another way that we're giving guidance and helping students distinguish ideas is shown where it says distinguishing ideas my system, which would be slide 41. So on slide 41, you can see that we can also support students to make diagrams instead of write essays. Some students find it difficult to express their ideas in words, but they are able to make this kind of a concept map. And we've found that when we look at scores for students who might be English language learners, that they're more sophisticated in their reasoning when they use a concept map than when they write an essay, which we would expect. And so the two together give them an opportunity to practice their language skills, but also to express their ideas perhaps more precisely using a concept map kind of diagram. We can also score these automatically. So if you go from slide 40 to slide 42, 43, and 44, you'll see that students can get guidance and that they can use that guidance to improve their concept map diagrams. I think at this point I'll take questions and comments on this kind of these ideas about distinguishing ideas. And if you want to look at some of my summary ideas, you can see those on slide 46. No, the next one. Back. Oh, there we go. 46. Okay, so questions or comments?
Hey, do you have any examples of how you score students' concept maps?
Yes, we have, we score the concept maps for knowledge integration just like we score the essays. So we're looking for students being able to make links among their ideas. In the case of the concept maps, we want to see that they're linking energy transfer and energy transformation. So a more sophisticated map would illustrate both the transfer and the transformation of energy in the process of global climate change. So the example that you have there shows that initially students aren't appropriately labeling the kind of energy that they've included in their concept map, and so they're being encouraged to go back and think about what kind of energy it really is. Is it energy from the sun, or is it, and then where does the transformation occur? So we're able to do that kind of scoring automatically, and we have some really good results showing that when students get guidance, essentially the same kind of guidance as before, where they're told to go back to look at the visualization more carefully, that they not only improve their responses, but they do better on the post-test at the end of the unit. Other questions?
Something I was just thinking about this morning was that interesting connection that you talked about. You talked about like the MOIS system helping language learners. I'm just thinking, have you thought about maybe how we could look into that more in terms of how the material is ordered?
Sequence.
I was getting a sense that within that help. Again, just people were asking the question about the how familiar they were with the visualization that it took to kind of figure out what was going on. But I certainly felt throughout the unit there was, it was quite coherent throughout, the students had a good sense and they were kind of building on it to become more familiar with the terms.
Mm-hmm.
So that they were more prepared for the essay items.
Yeah, so the question, the question here is, would it be better for them to do the My System diagrams first and then do the, essays so that they would have a chance to really summarize their ideas with the icons before they have to articulate them in words. And I think for some students especially, that's a really good idea. Any other questions? Okay, well, one of the other ways that we're supporting distinguishing ideas is with our idea basket and collaborative idea manager. And Astrid wanted to give some insight into how that works. And you can find that information starting on slide 48, I think.
What is that?
Yeah, 47 and 48. So Astrid, do you want to talk a little bit about the collaborative idea manager?
Sure. So the idea manager is something I worked together with Camelia during my visiting scholarship in Berkeley for the past 6 months. And I thought it was very interesting, this feature of the idea manager within WISE, because it allows students to generate ideas, and not only generate ideas, but actually to share them among classmates. So it's really cool, like they can you have their own ideas and they can look at the ideas of classmates, and then they can also make comparisons. And if you look on slide 48, this is actually showing the collaborative aspect of the idea manager. What we have done, we have asked the students to pick ideas of classmates that they disagree with, and we were asking them why they disagree with those ideas, and also maybe have suggestions on how to revise them. And what we did in a small study is to compare, like, how they reacted when they critiqued the ideas of the classmates. So that was really cool to see, and we're currently analyzing the findings. We will see about that.
I wonder, Annalise, if you could also comment on your experience in helping students distinguish ideas, if that would be okay.
Hello. Yes, I really like the ID manager, and but the we didn't work with the ID manager because I think we work with more older students. Our students are 14, 15 years old, and so if we think about IDs and creating IDs, we also want to focus on searching the web for more information. And then I think with the ID manager, they can say it's an evidence step, or but we wanted more that students added more information about the source and the quality of the internet sources. So then for the last study, we didn't decide to work with the ID manager, but I really like the idea of, generating ideas, adding ideas, but my experience is because we work with students from grades 9 and 10, we didn't use the ID manager.
Thank you very much. Annalise has a great paper coming out in ILS, and I encourage you to read it. She's done some fabulous work on how students come to understand complex ideas. And I also, I think her point is well taken. We find that for older students, they prefer to get their ideas from the web and other sources. And for students in middle school, they're quite happy to be able to look at, to share each other's ideas in the collaborative idea manager.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I think it's really successful, you know, that you make this overcome from the visual concept map, because you know, students are very much used now to learn in images, considering all the visual information around them and all the visual information they found on the internet. So I think it's really good when they kind of create their learning and construct their learning on the first step by making their concept map by images, and then coming to the collaborative idea manager, they formulate the ideas in words. I mean, I think this is a really kind of successful way of students making them, putting their ideas in words.
Thank you for that. That's a really good observation. I mean, I think it's really difficult to help students do this, and the more different ways that we can use, the better.
Oh, sorry, I didn't want to interrupt this time. I had a question with respect to how these scaffolds, I'm very impressed about also the development over recent years of the scaffolds and also the adaptive or the automated analysis and the adaptive part is what my question is addressing now. So can these automated analysis also be used to, well, more or less change the scaffolding? And because ultimately in an inquiry learning environment, I guess in the end there should not be any scaffolding remaining in the system, and students should be self, more or less self-regulated and self-directed. So how can we get rid of these scaffolds once they are not no longer of any use, and can these automated scoring technology be of any help in that?
That's an excellent question. One of the things that, I mean, I completely agree with you. We'd like students to be able to do their own inquiry, and these are on-ramp activities that will help them become able to inquire on their own. And one of the reasons that we use the knowledge integration steps, the eliciting ideas, adding ideas, and then really all these different ways to help students distinguish ideas, and finally also encouraging students to reflect. And if you look at slide, let's see, it must be 50, that says why promote reflecting. I mean, in the end, one of the most important challenges, oh, 51. One of the most important challenges is to help students deal with new information that they encounter after they're done with our science classes. So that's when we really want them to be able to do their own inquiry, to look at, you know, a claim, for example, about the climate, and think about their own evidence and use it to either incorporate that claim or refute it. And one of the biggest challenges is just the fact that in order to discourage people from thinking seriously about scientific evidence, there's been a misinformation sort of campaign, especially this all started with research on tobacco smoking, but that many people who don't want you to believe certain things try to just increase doubt. They know the evidence is good, but they try to increase doubt so that you're maybe not as certain that you should believe that evidence. And of course, that's, you know, something we really want to prepare students to think about. Is somebody giving me this good evidence and then encouraging doubt simply because they don't want me to consider the evidence, or are they giving me this, you know, encouraging doubt because there really is doubt? And I mean, there, of course, is always doubt, but how much doubt? And I think that preparing students to be able to do that on their own is a crucial thing. So one of the things that we've been thinking about with regard to the automated guidance, Frank, is could we move the automated guidance part over to a certification activity where we would, you know, you do your own inquiry, but then you have to pass certain certification accomplishments. You have to get certified, you know, to be good at inquiry at various levels or for various kinds of new evidence. So, you know, we might have an activity where we do actually give you some kind of a persuasive message and ask you to figure out how to interpret that message, and then we would automatically score your response and use that information to say, you know, yeah, you're becoming better at inquiry. So you would do your own inquiry, but then we would have ways of assessing the progress that you're making in inquiry that are independent of your own inquiry. I don't know, does that help? Does that give you some sense of where we're...
Yeah, thank you.
So Marsha, we would have a question here. We've been discussing in front of the webinar a bit, and we were thinking about what happens after the inquiry part of the learning. Would you use some kind of wrap-up session or something about the climate change after the students did their own inquiry? Do you like sum up everything, put everything on a worksheet? Do the teacher do this, or is it just what the students take along from their inquiry session and they have to do it themselves, or how do you proceed there?
My question is also related to the scaffold, so I'm wondering if you really have in the WISE system different type of guidance to students with different abilities, because that would be interesting to know.
Definitely. I think that's a really good question. So the reflection activities that we have in the WISE unit ask students to do things like write a letter to their congressman, advocating for certain kinds of policies, or to have a debate with maybe some look at a video from climate deniers and just have a debate to discuss how they would respond. So the overall WISE activity would include those kinds of integrative follow-on activities that really involve both distinguishing ideas and reflecting on what you know. Marianne?
Okay, sorry, maybe I should ask again. So I'm more interested in knowing whether you had different types of scaffolds to students with different abilities, because you sort of in the paper outlined that, for example, high achievers would benefit more from different types of scaffolds compared to students with low ability.
Hi, we do have, we are exploring differentiating scaffolds for different students. One thing that we've already found is that we've been contrasting knowledge integration guidance, which is the guidance you've been looking at, where students are asked, you know, given some evaluation of their answer, and there's a slide that tells you kind of a summary of our knowledge integration guidance, and then asked to go and look at some new evidence in order to improve their answer. And we've contrasted that with more specific guidance that just sort of says do this. And what we found is that for low pretest score students, the more elaborated knowledge integration guidance is far more effective than specific guidance. I think when students get specific guidance and they're pretty unsure about what they're thinking, the specific guidance just means that they just fill things in, they don't think about it. Whereas the knowledge integration guidance really asks them to think about it, and we try very hard to make the knowledge integration guidance incremental, so it's not too big of a leap from what they put down in their response. And in several studies now, we've been able to show that the knowledge integration guidance works better for low-performing students, but that, you know, high pretest score students don't need as much guidance. They can deal with the specific or the knowledge integration. And I think that often misleads people into thinking that specific guidance is fine. But in fact, our findings are that it's not.
Yeah, hello. I would like to comment on this issue because indeed our study just published in the Journal of the Learning Sciences also confirms this finding that a wise learning environment with a knowledge integration approach benefit more the low achieving students and also benefit more the girls who benefit more from discussing the topic than high achievers. So I think this is also a bit an answer on Marion's question. Thank you.
I just wanted to raise another question. Not sure if we can, if Marcia, if you would like to comment on that. We have been at a retreat the last couple of days with Clark Chin and others, Beate Solian and so on, and some of our doctoral students, or many of our doctoral students actually, and we discussed the question of the domain generality or domain specificity also of scientific reasoning. And in this context, I wonder, these scaffolds, is that are they to some extent domain specific? So do we need specific scaffolds for biology, or is it easy to generalize from biology to say physics and chemistry? How is your approach in Berkeley dealing with this, with domain differences also?
I think that's a really interesting question. What we are finding is that you definitely need to do iterative refinement on the scaffolds in order to make them fully successful. So some scaffolds don't work the first time at all, and then they have to be refined. The scaffolds that you saw for the ozone response, we've been really working on those because this is a really common belief. I think what happens is students don't really know what to say, and so they say, oh, and by the way, it's just the ozone hole. You know, I don't have to think about it anymore. I'll just put that down. And so how do you scaffold people to rethink that idea without just saying, oh, you know, that's wrong? Because we already know if you tell people it's wrong, it doesn't really do a bit of good. So what we've been trying to do is to really refine the guidance within each question area. On the other hand, I think the general recommendation to distinguish ideas, whether you use essays or concept maps or maybe drawing activities. I didn't show those, but Anna Rafferty and Libby Girard have done some really nice work on having students draw chemical reactions, and that came out in our recent science paper. So I think that in all cases, the general notion of distinguishing ideas, finding ways to help people do that, is a good thing to think about in designing scaffolds. But the second step is making sure the scaffolds work for your audience and in general for the students that in the topic area that you're studying. And ultimately, we'd really like these kind of distinguishing ideas patterns to become practices that students reuse often. And so making them somewhat general from situation to situation can be valuable.
So I don't know if you're already in the question part or if you still would want to present something, but I'd be really interested if you have any comparisons between inquiry learning with artifacts, like in physics, for example, where you have things in front of you, a battery, wire and so on, and inquiry learning on the computer, if there are any, yeah, if you can say anything about the learning effects from the digital and the analog inquiry learning. So if I see it right, she's gone at the moment, so you perhaps, there she's back.
Very, very good question. I published a paper with Tan Dejong in Science this year comparing hands-on labs to virtual labs to hands-on labs. And I mean, essentially the finding there is that there were no differences between the two, that either one works reasonably well for certain circumstances. But that's really just the very high-level story. Of course, there are really important things that you can only do in hands-on labs. And there are many kind of more esoteric things, like exploring the things that you can't see, or things that are too vast, like the solar system, or things that are too fast, like airbag deployments, that are really better or more effectively done with virtual experiments. To me, the most obvious thing is to combine these two, that there really are important things to learn. There's important techniques to learn with hands-on experimentation. And in most of our activities, but not all of them, we do have hands-on activities that go along with the WISE online activities. And I think the teachers and the students both feel like different skills are learned under those circumstances. And often the act of comparing the hands-on experiment results to the virtual experiment results really helps students understand the nature of error in this area.
So not sure what your plan is, Marsha and Astrid, but as we are approaching towards the end of the webinar, to at least for the official time, and I know that Marsha has not much more time, I would have two more questions that we ask all our presenters, and I would like to ask them to you both as well. But Marsha, what is your plan?
Ask your questions. That would be great.
Okay, so I would have the question on the problem or the possible problem if actually with inquiry learning, because only some topics maybe work with it, or some topics also in some domains work better with it. For example, like the typical science domains work probably better with it than other domains. And if you see any danger in there that the method we are using will shape actually the content we are teaching, just because the content can be taught with this method. So I would love to hear your opinion on that. If you think that there's a certain danger here that we should look out for, that the method is actually kind of dictating the content.
That's a really good question. So one of my concerns is that our regular science instruction, often students can't figure out why they're bothering to learn anything. And I think that inquiry activities are much more likely to include the possibility of connecting to personally relevant problems. So, I mean, global climate change is a personally relevant problem. Understanding the safety of airbags is a personally relevant problem. And there's many, many more. And I think using inquiry activities to allow students to explore things that they care about is a really important aspect of science instruction. So, I mean, I would argue kind of the other side, that by focusing on inquiry, we're more likely to engage students in something that will make, will convince them that science is valuable. Now, of course, there are plenty of bad hands-on experiments that don't convince you that anything is valuable, but I think that it's more possible to design an activity that might connect to people's concerns and real-world experiences in the area of inquiry when you use a combination of technology and hands-on experimentation. Whether there are topics where it's not necessary or where it's just not efficient, I think are things that we all have to face. Inquiry does take some time. It's a good thing to take that time because it builds in the learner a propensity towards inquiry and develops the practice of inquiry that you really need to use all the time when you're encountering information in your lives or trying to make decisions such as, you know, which is this an energy efficient decision, or healthcare decisions really involve a lot of research and resolution of alternatives often. So I think it's very important to emphasize that. But in the honor of efficiency, of course, we just can't do inquiry about everything in the classroom. And so I think there always has to be a balance. As far as whether inquiry shapes the content that we emphasize, I mean, I guess that I think that maybe it does in some situations, but I would hope that we would use inquiry to increase students' appreciation of the beauty and value of science in their lives. And I think inquiry is a better way to do that than having textbooks or lectures as the primary focus of instruction.
Okay, thanks for these answers. So I have two questions. One is, I think we asked that all our presenters, why is your topic, so why is inquiry learning important for the learning sciences? And I don't think that anyone here doubts that inquiry learning is a central topic in the learning sciences, but I think what would be great to hear from both of you is, so why is that the case? What characteristics of the learning sciences make inquiry learning thus important for our field? Why is it such a central approach in our field? So first question, and I come back with my second.
Really a great question. You know, I think one of the things that really is a signature of the learning sciences is the multidisciplinarity of the teams that contribute to the research program. And I think inquiry is one of the most important things that we can do in a multidisciplinary way. First, because there's so many cultural issues. I mean, people have very definite cultural practices and beliefs that they bring to any scientific inquiry activity. And as I said before, when you make inquiry more personally relevant, you're more likely to elicit these cultural beliefs. People who believe, for example, that you know, ice melting isn't important, or don't understand or have concerns about whether there's a political conspiracy going on, et cetera, concerning global climate change, then I think those are opportunities to really think about how do all of our cultural experiences contribute to our ability and to learn in our decisions concerning how we design instruction. In addition, I think the learning sciences has really emphasize the importance of bringing together disciplinary experts, assessment experts, experts in technology, and experts in the neurosciences to think jointly about problems that are of importance to everyone. And that's why I think inquiry is such a crucial thing for us to be considering in the learning sciences, is that we really need all of these experts to help us advance this agenda.
Thank you. I would like to connect to what Marcia just said. I mean, like, first of all, from the area of inquiry learning, when you look at the kind of research, a lot of discussion is about how much support is useful for learners to guide the learner through a problem. So So in inquiry learning, one of the main topics that we are discussing is what is the best, most optimal level to support to allow learners to work and to learn autonomously. That's the one thing why I think inquiry learning is a great area that should be represented in the learning sciences. And for me, of course, it was a great opportunity because I could I could have different roles within in projects. For instance, on one hand, I was working with the programmers together in the background to design agents and to support learning in the background. Then I was allowed to work with pedagogues in the classroom, with teachers. So we as researchers, we can take on very different roles and represent different roles within inquiry learning, which is of course a fantastic thing and a lot of fun.
Thank you to both of you, very convincing. But I have a second question. So we mentioned earlier that WISE and inquiry learning environments are used all over the world, also in PhD projects. But anyway, creating a new inquiry learning project, creating a WISE module, for example, can be quite demanding, I would say, if you develop your own curriculum, develop the scaffold and so on. So what would be your recommendation, also Astrid and Marcia again, to PhD students, if they are interested in that approach, inquiry learning, and wanted to include something in their dissertation or even want to focus on inquiry learning, what is important to focus on or to be aware of?
Well, it's a great question. As you saw today, we have many collaborators who have, some have written their own activities, which is, as you mentioned, a very big undertaking, but other people have taken WISE activities. Some of them have been translated. They've been translated into many different languages. We have a very interesting group in Argentina who are running their projects in Spanish right now. And asking new questions, but using the existing activities. And I think this is not only a great PhD research undertaking, because you can stand on the shoulders of giants, you can take advantage of all the people that have been refining and building that activity in the past, but it also allows you to compare the findings that you gain to some of those other investigations, and supports the overall long-term trajectory of really trying to understand questions that we're facing in the learning sciences more generally. So, building on the work of others by using some of the tools that others use, but customizing them and designing them to serve your own research question, I think is something that we need more of, frankly, in the learning sciences. And using WISE is one possibility. There are many wonderful learning environments out there. In fact, Dermot Donnelly and I and Sven Ludvigsen have just completed a paper which will come out in RER sometime soon, really summarizing the findings across the nature of all the learning environments that are out there, and characterizing the kind of features that they have. And I think using these kind of environments, because you can track student work, you can data mine the findings, you can do precise comparisons between different conditions, is really an opportunity. So not just WISE, but SCI and other wonderful learning environments really do provide a paradigm for us to do learning trajectories that give us more cumulative understanding in the field, something that I think we really need to focus on as we as this field becomes more mature.
Thanks. Just one quick follow-up question, because I know that some of us here are not so familiar with the WISE projects. Would you point us to some WISE projects where you think it would be a good starting point, because they are interesting, they are also more or less validated in classrooms, they have interesting scaffolds, so where to start if you want to use WISE? Is there a specific pointer that you can give to some of the projects?
Yeah, here we go. The library at wise.berkeley.edu, we're putting that into the chat, and it's also on the final slides, will give you a good set of activities. The global climate activity that also has its link in the chat is a really fun one to explore, and actually it's one of the activities that has multiple versions. So if people are interested in using that in their research, we would be more than happy to make available to you several different versions for you to create a customized activity of your own. I should point out that WISE has a very, very easy to use authoring system, and even teachers make changes to the projects when they're teaching. But certainly for researchers, I think Annalise and others who have used WISE can tell you that they can make customizations relatively straightforwardly and put in the kinds of activities that they want to study in their research. Besides the activity on global climate, Camelia Matuk has really built a very lovely mitosis activity, which is available in the library, and has the idea manager and some of our other, the annotator as well, right, Camelia? Yeah, so two of our newest tools, the idea manager and the annotator, can be found in the mitosis activity in the WISE library. So the global climate change activity and the mitosis activity, and then there's a very interesting new version of our graphing stories activity, which is also in the library, and that is helping people understand position and time graphs, and has a number of different animation possibilities, and John Vitale is working on that. And he would love, if people are interested in extending or collaborating on that, he has tried a number of different approaches using the visualizations, and he'd be happy to have others vary the visualizations and see how effective they are. One of the interesting things in that activity is that we're able to engage students in doing kind of less precise, you know, like you want to summarize the possible motion and you have some constraints but not others, so there's multiple solutions. You know, how do you create this constrained but not perfectly constrained representation of position and motion? And that turns out to be really interesting for students in the classroom to think about, and teachers are also quite excited to work with that kind of situation. Anyway, thank you all very much. Thank you, Ibrahim. I'm so glad you were able to join us. And all of you, you've been such a marvelous audience. The questions are just fabulous. Please feel free to email me and our team if you have more questions or are interested in knowing more about what we're doing. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Bye, Marsha. Thank you very much from Munich. We all enjoyed it, and some of us were there the first try, and we came back, and I think it was worthwhile. One organizational issue for everyone. There's an evaluation of the webinar series going on, and I'm just putting the link into the chat. And we'd be really grateful if all of you would do this online form. It takes 2 to 3 minutes. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Marsha, for this great talk. It was fun collaborating. It was a really nice time. Thanks.
Thank you. Also, thanks to all the participants. I think what I learn every time again when I listen to Marsha and also follow her work is that there is a way to develop a theoretical model and develop a technology that really is working over the years, can be further developed and can be really used in schools. And this is really impressive. There are not much examples of this. I'm really happy to collaborate with your group in Berkeley, and I think and this is really true. If people ask me, is there any example or are there examples where people develop theories and develop technologies related to these theories or building on these theories that then find their ways into schools? I'm not sure. Maybe this is an open question. If there are many more examples than just the WISE group, for example.
Thank you very much, Marsha, for a very interesting presentation. I follow you very closely, and I just wanted, before I leave, just wanted to say hello to Ingeborg. We are waiting for you back in Norway.
Bye-bye, everyone. It was very nice this talk and to see you again. And say hello to also to Hiroki and all the other people from Berkeley, which I miss because I had a good time 2 years ago already. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you all so much. This was really fabulous. Visit us anytime. We will look forward to continued collaboration with all of you. Bye-bye.